I'm Ken Rosenthal from Fox and MLB Network. This is Mark Shapiro, president of the Cleveland Indians. Back in his baseball days, general manager days, two times
executive of the year.
He's happy to push me out right off the edge.
That's what I mean.
Mark has a long career in baseball at this point, 21 years. Started in 1992 with the Indians, his entire career has been with the Indians. And in his career, he has played a variety of roles, from assistant in the baseball operations department, place where you start.
Cubicle dweller. Cubicle dweller. It was the
office expansion
that
looked
in
Moneyball?
Oh my god.
No.
Still isn't. I aspire to those offices. Those look like the spring training offices for the Rockies and Diamondbacks.
Rockies and Diamondbacks are still in this part of the place. But anyway, Mark went on to become farm director from 94 to 98. And then
assistant
GM for the John Hart.
Right.
99 to 2001, and then took over as general manager. Now, yesterday we talked a little bit about the growth of analytics and how it all started. And Jerry DePoto made the point, hey, it's been going on forever. When I was looking at Rod Carew's baseball card, and certainly the history of analytics goes way back before the rise of computers or anything like that. At the same time, what has given such momentum to the movement is the explosion of information. And what we're going to talk about with Mark is basically how things have changed in his world and all our worlds, but especially in baseball, since he started way back when. Pre-cell phones?
Yeah. I think the only people that had them were just the GM and assistant GM. That was it. The game reports were called in by a fax, you know, and then transcribed. I think modem came to the first or second year with the modem.
All right, so this is when you start. Let's start in 1992. What was it like in baseball operations with regards to analytics and what was about?
Yeah, so I think decision making, right? That's the best way to look at it, and because that's the best application for analysis and data and technology. And for me, you know, the convergence of those three is what's most interesting. You know, one of the three, you know, analysis without the data is not that meaningful, but when you converge the three of those things, the amount of data being generated today, whether it's just HD video, which is, you know, 2.5 million times the amount of data we had, you know, back in 1992, or you look at, you know, pitch FX and what that generates, you know, compared to what we had and on the verge of hidden field FX and our own proprietary data that we can develop. So it's managing the data, it's doing the analysis, it's having a technology to apply it. So the data, the technology in 1992 were stat books in our laps as we sat around the room. It was filing cabinets behind John Hart's desk that had scouting reports that were printed off. And a lot of time was spent compiling the information to make a decision. You know, so the variables that go into a decision are, you know, medical, psychological, or mental, financial, statistical, and obviously that's been elevated to another level, but still we had statistics that we looked at, and then subjective information, scouting reports. And someone like me in a cubicle and two or three other people would be, you know, charged with, we have a trade, get this information together. And we would start pulling media guys literally off behind and pull the biographical information. We would start, you know, going to the scouting and reading scouting reports and summarize, and that's literally what we did. And then kind of make a presentation to John, who had to make a decision, and John would get on the phone and call scouts, or if we were at winter meetings, you know, scouts would raise their hands, you know, with the books in their laps, and, you know, and talk about the decision. So, you know, along the way, it's been an evolution, not one thing, not, you know, a movie may lead you to believe there's just, you know, one organization at one moment in time kind of changed the world, but, and they did lead a lot of maybe what was done, but there's been a group of people who I think, you know, have always pushed for how do we apply technology? Where can we look for advantages? Where are the incremental efficiencies? Where are they, you know, where do they lie? And how can we, frankly, just look for, you know, areas where we can beat people and find small, you know, opportunities to do that? It's been more and more important for us as our market has dramatically changed. You know, we have to bridge the gaps, you know, in a multitude of ways now. Rather than just exploit, you know, resources, which is, you know, what we did before. And I think it's been more essential the way we make decisions. And, you know, now, and I think what, you know, Chris, you heard yesterday talking to GM, when he really led as an assistant GM, was let's flip the model from spending 80% of our time assembling the information and 20% of our time analyzing it to let's, you know, develop technology that allows us to compile the information in almost in real time, or, you know, all the time, have really smart people analyzing it, and then, you know, we can spend much more time analyzing it and applying it to making a decision, and hopefully make more decisions correctly or right more frequently, because we're flipping that model.
Now, when did the sea change occur in simply the amount of information available? I remember talking to Paul DePodesta, who of course is now at the Mets, former assistant GM of the A's, general manager of the Dodgers. He told me he could remember.
Start with the innings.
How about you, right?
Dan and I both were about
the
time.
Sorry about that.
Yeah.
But anyway, he told me that he could remember the day when he was told, he was driving along on some back road scouting, and he pulled over the side of the road and was told that they could now get the radio to the dad.
Right.
And it was that meaningful moment. Do you remember such a moment where things kind of came together?
I mean, I can remember, you know, it's, you know, John Hart's computer in his office never being turned on. Him saying, I'm not turning this thing on until I can touch the screen, which is, you know, think about that. He was joking. Until I can turn it on and touch the screen, I'm, you know, John, I'm sure he's an iPad user now. You know? He's touching the screen. He's got a tablet, and he's probably doing it. So I know I get text messages from him, so he's definitely texting, you know. But you know, I just think, you know, it's at a certain point in time, you know, there was an openness to a different type of executive, you know, a different type of front office personnel. And, you know, when I came in, it was, you know, I used to joke the five families. There was, the, you know, there were a very small number of the McPhails, the Fazies, the Quins, you know, a small number of people who were a lot of great executives, but historical executives in the game. There were ex-players, and there really was no role for anyone outside of that. I got a great opportunity from John and Dan, and I was empowered to make, you know, to really make some changes. And then they started a pattern where Josh Burns started with us, and Paul DePodesta started with us, and Neil Huntington, and Chris Antonetti, and, you know, and I think that I would say it started with people. It started with, you know, intellectual capital. And let's find some really smart people, combine them with great baseball people, and see if you bring these people together and empower them to improve the decision-making process and improve the quality of information and elevate the processes throughout the organization in general without ever disrespecting, you know, the game or the tradition or what makes it special, you know, how much better can you be? And that race for smarter, more talented people who still understand and respect the culture, that's extremely important, or it's ineffective anyway, you know, to me is what changed the tide. And now it's just, it's a nonstop. You wake up every day, what am I missing? You know, you read, you know, trade rumors, you read Fanalytics, you read an article on Prospectus, and you're like, are we doing this? You know, I always get the answer, yes, we've already looked into that, yes. You know, but I wake up with that anxiety, you know, because there's constantly new frontiers being pushed. And there's an openness to who can make us better. And that's kind of, you know, when young people come to me and say, you know, how do I get in? You know, how do I start? You know, my response is, you know, we look for people that the day they walk through the door will make us better. You know, we look for people that have demonstrated at some point already that they're going to come in the door and they're going to continue to elevate our thinking and push us, or have done something either in video or in scouting or in analytics that are going to help us be better the day they walk through the door.
Now, you talked about Chris Antonetti flipping the model. Now, I assume one reason you could go more heavy for analysis availability of data, I think, more quickly put together. I'm wondering, without giving away any proprietary secrets, what did Chris do to basically get the Indians going in that direction?
I think it was more reverse engineering. You know, we looked at it from a decision. What information would we want to have in a decision? You know, and that's where we started from. You know, you've got, like I said, I look at every decision, and this is the beauty of baseball. We can talk about analytics and data and technology all we want. But at the bottom line, when you get down to a decision, A, our assets are still human. They're not stocks. They're not real estate. They're flesh. They are filled with frailties that are going to allow us to never predict them. And B, there's still an art to the ultimate decision, the final decision, because no computer and no program is ever going to spit out the answer. You know, what the information does and what the data does and what technology does and what the brilliant analysts do are give us better input to allow us to make the decision. How you weight that input and how you factor that into your own operating conditions and circumstances and develop a strategy and how consistently you execute on that strategy, you know, rather than get impacted by emotion and momentum, by writers and broadcasters and fans and just, you know, think about it this way, you know, a guy or a woman making a major executive decision for a publicly traded company has to deal with stock price, which is can affect your emotions. You know, I've got to walk into my son's school every day and hear his teacher tell me his opinion. I've got to walk to the barber, you know, at lunch and have him tell me his opinion. Everybody else waiting to get a haircut tell me their opinions. I've got to deal with the guy, you know, at the counter checking out, you know, getting a deli sandwich, and then pick up the paper in the morning, and even if I say I'm not going to read it, open it up and see it scroll across the top, you know, Indians fall three back to the Tigers, you know, desolate, you know, whatever. The emotion and the amount of, you know, can impact any strategy. So the ability to maintain a strategy to kind of wall yourself off as best you possibly can from that emotion and momentum that swirls around you, that lies in more of an objective process, and that lies in a framework for making a decision. So I think there's still, you know, you can have great input, and we've tried to always elevate the quality of the input, but how you apply it to a decision and whether or not you stay that course and whether an owner allows you to stay that course are still going to be, are going to vary from team to team.
Okay, looking back, can you give us an example of a decision that was maybe emotional, that there were a variety of factors that might have led to it? We talked about this yesterday, how you have to look at these things in context, not they right. Just overpaying you. There are always factors and always explanations. Anything that stands out to you is like, wow, this is an emotional decision that we never should have gotten.
I'll have to think about that as we're talking and see if I can come up with one. You know, I mean, I look back, man, the best one I can give you, not necessarily an emotional decision, but maybe the evolution of the process, would be my very first year as general manager. You know, we knew that we were on the verge of rebuilding. We knew that privately, but the Indians, there's someone in here from Menor, I see, it's Richard, right? Right, so we were, you know, off the mid-90s Indians, we were dominant. We were in the playoffs 6 or 7 years, 2 American League championships, 455 straight sellouts. You know, it was an incredible era of Indians baseball, which you were around for, and we talked a lot through. And of course, I got my opportunity right as we were reaching the end of that, because that's what usually happens. And I had to chart a strategy and a course back if I had to sit down with ownership. And so doing that and doing an objective self-assessment, I'm sitting there going, I really don't know what to have back. I mean, depleted farm system, aging players, expiring contracts, diminishing revenues at a level we had no idea. We didn't have any idea where they were really going. And, you know, tough answers. So I made in my very first winter meeting a trade that was squarely in the middle, you know. Couldn't be the guy to come in and just say we're rebuilding, you know, and couldn't be the guy to ignore it either because I didn't want to go through, you know, we start traditional rebuilds are 8 to 10 years. I mean, it's losing up to pick in the very top. Sooner or later, you're going to get good. And, you know, that's a tough thing to bite. You know, if you've been winning as much as we have, it's tough to bite off and accept. So, you know, we traded Robbie Alomar again, some prospects, Alex Escobar, Jared Riggin, Matt Lawton, signed Ricky Gutierrez. You know, I go back to that trade and I think about how we made it, the processes involved. We extended Matt Lawton before we even had him in camp. We signed Ricky Gutierrez to a multi-year deal without having the right level of information. Those were decisions that were made by me trying to, A, operate like John Hart. And now I'm not John, all the same strengths, you know, not the same, I can't make decisions the same way he makes them. You know, based a lot on his own baseball acumen and ability and evaluation. And a little bit based on that desire to not let down our fans and the emotion. You know, flip that 3 months forward to trading Bartolo Colon. Just 3 months later, after we made that trade, I immediately knew, in a short period of time in spring training, Chris and I together, that's not how we can make trades. That's not how I can make a decision.
The first trade,
yes. The Lawton trade. Not how I can make a decision, and not how I'm going to be successful. I'm going to fail if I try to be John Hart. You know, I got to be Mark Shapiro, play my own strengths. And You know, what we did at that point, we deployed our scouts in a very strategic way of the teams we thought could be a Cologne trade partner. We, you know, began to spend 3 months looking at objective analysis and data. You know, we assembled all the subjective information we could, the mental, the character, the makeup. We started doing mental, you know, we started doing medical research, and we were prepared. And still, let me tell you, when I sat in my office the night on June 26th of, you know, 2002, the night before we made the Cologne trade, that came across the ESPN scroll, by the way, Bartolo Cologne traded for Lee Stevens and 3 minor leaguers. So you can imagine how popular. You can tell, Cliff Lee, Grady Sizemore, and Brandon Phillips were the 3 minor leaguers. But that's not what fans in Cleveland thought. You know, they thought, you know, it was the first time, and I was the guy that made the decision. Not just fans, by the way. Fans, major leagues, field staff, front office personnel, other than the 8 people around me, despite the way it looked in Moneyball, just the 8 people in baseball operations. The 8 people in baseball operations. You know, besides those 8 people who knew and were involved, everybody else, we were letting everybody down. You know, I was letting everyone down as leader of the baseball. So talk about emotion and talk about, you know, but, you know, at that moment in time, I said, you know what, we have all these legitimate reasons why we were headed towards this bad cliff. And, you know, no one really cares. You know, my job is to find a way to win. My job is to find a way out of this. My job is to find a strategy and a course out of it. And the way to do it, in my mind, was to start to execute on a series of decisions, you know, that were all well executed and made in a way that I could accept, right or wrong. You know, and that's the point. And you're never going to still all make the right decisions. I can think back to, you know, trading for Andy Marte, and very few guys ever lined up the way Andy Marte, and he didn't turn out. You know, and I can, every day of the week, still sleep with that decision because I know our process was good on every side of the equation. You know, we didn't do anything. It was just, the reality is you're not gonna get every guy right. Same thing with Matt LaPorta, you know, struggling right now. Maybe he still will turn out, but I know what our process was on Matt LaPorta, and, you know, I feel good about the process.
And we talked yesterday a lot about, you mentioned human element, and I think of Phillips a little bit. Mm-hmm. Here's a guy that it didn't work in Cleveland. He had to get traded again for him to realize his potential. What happened there? What led to that decision?
Yeah, so interesting because, you know, there were 30 teams in Major League Baseball. You know, he would have cleared waivers probably except for one team, and that team had, I had to talk into trading for him, you know, because beyond the waiver price. So it wasn't just us. It's like, you know, people say, did you pass on Yuclis? Every team in baseball passed on Yuclis for 5 rounds of the draft. I mean, you know, it's one of those things where Brandon was at a point where he had gotten a lot of big league at bats and hit 200. You know, and the things he was doing fundamentally in his hitting, he was like watching a guy bang his head against the wall. You know, it was insanity. He was not making adjustments. And but I guess I still feel good about the player he is because I feel like the evaluation we made in acquiring him has come to reality. But sometimes it doesn't align with where you are as a team. And we were a team with championship expectations, coming off a 93-win year, and it was arguing over the 25th guy on the club, and it was one of those times when the front office didn't align with the manager. Wedgie will tell you that. And I didn't feel like that was one I'm going to cram down Eric's throat in the process of managing, you know, your relationship with the manager, which is a challenge to do. You know, I didn't feel like fighting that battle for the 25th man was the right battle to fight. And so, you know, we traded him, and we kept Ramon Vasquez, you know.
But it's interesting that we talked about this yesterday.
Yeah, what makes it successful?
Many things that go into the trade that Mark just talked about.
I just think it's timing, you know? He ends up being the player that everybody thought he would be and we thought he would be. It just didn't happen in our time frame.
Right, but there was a disagreement with the manager. There was an ability on his part to become the player.
Right, maturity.
All of these things go into it.
Yeah, you know, other examples, like what makes Casey Blake, you know, toil for 9 years in the minor leagues and then when we're a rebuilding team, be able to provide him with an opportunity and then blossom into a 10-year career as a solid big leaguer, you know? So sometimes it's just, when does that opportunity come? What are the conditions and circumstances? And that's where, you know, we're getting away a little bit from the objective analysis, and although we applied them to the decision even to sign Casey as a minor leaguer, and there's some human element that you can't quite measure, on the psychological side and the mental side and what makes the conditions right. And that's really a great frontier that continues to be explored, and we continue to push the envelope as to, you know, what are the optimal conditions for a person to ultimately achieve their potential. It's always about that gap between potential, you know, and performance. Where is it? You know, performance is here, potential is here. The great players bridge that gap, and that's what player development is. You know, it's how consistently you can help a guy bridge that gap. The great players bridge that gap most consistently.
To now, and to your role as club president. So before I get right into that, there was something we talked about, I think in September, and in analytics, how everyone is caught up. How teams like yourself and Oakland, Boston, that had this edge is no longer there. Deploying analytics very heavily. And for a team in a low revenue situation, it makes it that much more challenging.
Yeah, so I think what, you know, what's most dramatically changed is that, and I really credit Theo with this, you know, is that some of the large market clubs have understood, you know. So when I first got in, that opportunity existed that the only place that they exploited their resources was Major League Free Agency. And I was fine with that. You know, I mean, because everyone out there, you guys know Major League Free Agency is an inefficient market. You know, so if they want to deploy their resources in Major League Free Agency, then we could find other areas to bridge gaps. We could find other areas to bridge payroll discrepancy and resource and revenue, you know, differences. But what happened is Theo kind of said, well, what if we exploit our resources not just in Major League Free Agency? What if we did it in the draft, in the international market, you know, in front office, in player development staff, in technology, and in every single area? And other teams, especially the Yankees, follow. Not every team has. There's still that opportunity out there. You know, the Cubs will now, as you heard yesterday. And so we've had to continue to look for new ways. And the opportunities have gotten smaller and smaller. And the windows are more and more of a reality. The cycles of winning that you and I talk about privately as well. And so that's really changed. There still are huge ranges of how people use that. Now, I think everybody, it's like when sports psychology became big, everybody has a sports psychologist. Everybody has one. I think it's almost to placate and check the box and say, you know, we have analytics department. You know, we utilize data, you know. Everybody has it to placate an owner, or different teams utilize it to different levels still. But the reality is that it's another area where resources can be exploited, you know, and hiring more people, having more capability to handle data and manage data, you know, there's resources make a difference on that frontier as well. And they didn't used to. It didn't used to be an area where resources mattered. It was an area where we could out-hustle, you know. We can't out-hustle now. We have to allocate a portion of our, you know, of our dollars to spend there.
It's funny, I remember last year, I don't know if you have told me this or someone else, but somebody told me as I was writing this story about analytics that the Yankees now have 20 full-time people doing analytics, 20 or more. So I called Brian Cashman, and I didn't think he would tell me this, but I said, hey, Brian, do you have 20 people working in analytics? That's what I heard. He goes, oh, yes. We have more than 20.
So I'm jealous. So we've grown from a very analytically savvy front office with guys like Mike Chernoff and Chris, who have some capability, mathematic and analytical capability, unlike a history major like myself, who has none. And two, you know, 3 years ago, Keith Woolner is one, you know, full-time, two, you know, four full-time people, which is, for us, is a, you know,
huge
explosion, you know, and that reality is it makes a difference at that point. I mean, that's not small. I mean, you guys can think about the amount of work that they're able to do and the amount of, you know, proprietary information they're able to and analysis they're able to come up with and how that can impact decisions. And you've got a GM who openly accepts that, you know, which makes a big difference too. So you talk about, you know, we've got to be that much better with the people we've got, and you know, it's certainly, that's one opportunity that existed for us. You know, just 10 years ago, that door has been closed. We've got to find other ones now.
Now, as club president, I wonder if you're able to apply some of these principles to what you're doing now, whether it's, I don't know, ticket pricing, or anything else.
You know, it's funny. So I'm still involved in the baseball side, but learning the business side, one of the things that's been most profound for me has been that the decision making is there are some great analogies. You know, when it gets down to the secondary market and setting ticket prices and a promotional schedule, you know, analyzing those, you're still getting a huge amount of data. You're still doing a lot of analysis, and you're still ultimately ending up with a recommendation that's not precise. You have to make, you know, a decision that involves factoring in a lot of objective analysis, but some subjective as well, and trying to make a good decision with that. So there are certainly some processes that I've been very comfortable dealing with, and that I feel like we've been able to elevate ourselves pretty quickly on the business side, because we didn't necessarily do that, much like our migration on the baseball side, you know, 10, 15 years ago.
Okay. You know, let's open it up to questions. I think we have a microphone out there, right? Here we go. And we'll start with that. We'll start with you right here. They're coming with the microphone.
An earlier presentation pointed out that over the last 10 years, I think it was, that the Cleveland Indians had a higher percentage of at-bats versus opposite-handed pitching than any other team in the major leagues. Mm-hmm. Is that something you obviously had set out to do, or how did that come out?
We're cognizant of what that means. I wouldn't say that's something that we set out to do as a primary strategy. I think, you know, we look at this year's team, and we're concerned about being left-handed dominant this year, and we're always aware of that, but, you know, we never get the ability to build a perfect lineup. You know, I think if you're in New York or Boston, you try to build a perfect lineup. You know, if you're in Texas right now, you try to build a perfect lineup. You know, when Chris talks about it, when he comes to me and we get down to making decisions, we try to build the best lineup we can, and it often deals with picking where your imperfections lie and trying to complement them as best you can with other parts of your team. So the short answer would be, looking at where our payroll has gone over 10 years, no, that would be coincidental. That was not an on-purpose strategy, although I think we're cognizant of what that means as we go through making decisions. We're largely, you know, and I think I've even told you that, you know, we're largely picking where our imperfections are. We're aware of them. You know, that's important. But, you know, when we enter into free agency, if we have to enter into it, which we always do, we don't have the luxury of picking where. We have to, you know, go wherever the value lies, and then do the best we can to fill our hole, and hope that where our primary needs fall, we have to just hope that a big market club is not, you know, in the market for the same players.
At the Sabre meeting last year in Long Beach, a certain high-profile player agent indicated or inferred that his early success...
Is there more than one high-profile?
Not that I know of. That his early successes in arbitration hearings was a direct result of his ability to assimilate more and better data than the people across the table from him.
I'm not sure he wants to brag about his arbitration record.
One thing. At any point in time early in the development of Major League Baseball starting the analytics, was that a key issue, and are you looking at that now as a key in arbitration to save millions and millions and millions of dollars?
So what Ken didn't say is I'm a son of an agent. You know, I grew up around the game. You know, my dad happened into being an agent, but I grew up around that side of the business, and brilliant lawyer, unbelievable advocate for players, and I think that's what, at some point, agents went from being advocates to players to being recruiters and retainers of players, and so that recruiting and retaining process, I think, is more statistically driven than analytically driven. I don't think very many agents are very sophisticated in their application of data, statistics, and analysis. He is certainly, and spends time on it. I'm not sure it gives him much ability to be successful very often, maybe in the players he chooses to go after, I'm not sure. But certainly the sophistication and the quality of our arbitration process has been elevated to a new level, but largely by the same front office people and the quality of the front office talent that I referred to. So it's been one of the many processes that's been elevated to another level, but of all the areas, with candor, not in reaction, you know, to any one person or even agents, I think we far outpace the agents in that in general. More just because we've elevated all of our practices. And unfortunately, arbitration still stays very true to its name, and regardless of how good your information is still very arbitrary. You know? And so we've stayed out of it since I've been with the Indians. You know, we've never gone to a case, and you know, I'd like to think because we're so prepared is the reason why, but also because we know the outcome is still, you know, a roll of the dice, no matter how good your information or your arguments are.
Mark's father, by the way, is Ron Shapiro, and if you don't know, he represented Cal Ripken, Eddie Murray, Kirby Puckett, and still today works as an agent. Joe Maurer is his guy, among others. Now, as for Scott, just to, well, we should not name him.
Did I say Scott?
He is the agent who cannot be named. I can tell you, because I do talk to all these guys, as Mark did when he was GMing now, he does have more information.
He does.
Yeah. And he works at it, and
nobody's more prepared than Scott on that side of the business.
It's kind of incredible, actually. And I remember this quote. This was an exaggeration, but Mike Gillis at the press conference where they signed Prince Fielder said, in talking to Scott, he knows my team better than I do. Now, I'm sure that is not exactly true, but there are instances where sometimes, yes, that may be the case.
Depends upon the owner.
Depends upon the owner.
In sabermetrics, I think people view batting as kind of a solved problem, and defense is where the interest is. And I'm not foolhardy enough to expect you to tell us what you're doing on the defensive side.
Right.
But I'm wondering what level of comfort you have with the defensive numbers your team produces versus what they might produce on the batting side.
Yeah.
Do you feel that you've got, you know, that for you defense is a...
So I can give you a good answer to that, actually. That won't really reveal very much. You know, we look at the defense statistics that are available to everybody, and we have our own proprietary defense statistics. I think where we feel we're at on the defensive, the objective measurement of defense today is somewhat around the equivalent of the value of batting average to offense. You know, so has some value, certainly limited, very limited value. It might be a little better than that now. We factor it in. It is certainly the area where we still feel like subjective and scouting information is still most important. The challenge with that is you're looking at scouts that might see a combined number of games, you know, 10 games of a guy, and you're making an evaluation based off that. We're obviously, as you, I'm sure you know, we're on the edge of, you know, a new frontier on the defensive objective measurement as well, and that's going to change a lot in the next 5 years. It'll be, again, how quickly you can utilize that information and that data, how quickly you can analyze it and apply it, and I think that's the race. It'll be a race, and someone will get it done faster, and then everybody will follow. It's like any market, right? Any, you know, financial market, really. Everyone's, then the inefficiency gets closed, and we're all looking for the next inefficiency to exploit.
Speaking of inefficiency, I would think that one of the things that's a source of inefficiency in baseball is the makeup of the player and the possibility that the makeup is not going to meet the talent of the player. Mm-hmm. Are there techniques, analytical approaches that you use to try to help players improve their particular makeup from the earliest on? I'm thinking specifically of someone like Brandon Phillips, but also maybe someone like Elijah Dukes.
Yeah. Okay, so I'll take that. Having been a farm director for a lot of years, and I would say the most important role that character or personality, you know, plays in decision making is at the time of acquisition, not of development. You know, like anything in life, when you inherit a person at between 18 and 21 years of age, their patterns of development are largely set. It's going to be very difficult to change it. Not impossible, but largely set. And so the inefficiency it takes to completely try to change someone's personality or makeup, it's going to be a lot of energy and resources and time. Sometimes the talent justifies that, sometimes it doesn't. So I think you know, what's more important is how you assess personality in the acquisition process. You try to do that objectively. We have a database now on a personality test that we use that we feel has been highly predictive, but more predictive of concerns than of, and limitations than of strengths and great makeup. And then I think, you know, some of it still gets down to how good are your coaches and evaluators and organization at understanding cultural differences and personalities and what makes people tick and you know, not and being patient, not falling prey to, you know, the emotion that you sometimes feel, the frustration you feel watching someone fail so much, you know, in this game. It is very important that when you make decisions that you pull back from, you know, some of the emotion at that single moment in time. Because I can go back and tell you, when I look at staff comments at the end of the season, the makeup and character comments often parallel the performance. You know, so a guy, and I think in specific people, can be a star makeup guy 1 year when he's performing well, and a bad guy the next year when he isn't performing well. And it often, you know, that graph runs pretty parallel. So we work to develop it. We have, you know, I consider our player development system to be holistic. It's mental, physical, fundamental. We spend resources and time on all three sides of that three-legged stool, and we want all three legs to be strong. And I think it still represents one of the greatest opportunities to beat people in player development. But what you start with is still most important.
Just wanted to thank you for the great running years you provided for AAA baseball to the city of Buffalo. It was great when you were our parents.
Proud of our time.
But you always clearly, I know the minor leagues is not always about winning and losing. You always stock the AAA team with the number of major league veterans that we had, and we always won there. That's some type of philosophy that you use. You're balancing winning with also using those veterans to teach the younger players coming up.
In general, winning versus development in the minor leagues is one philosophy. I think you want to develop players who expect to win. You know, you need to balance it, and every manager in the minor leagues has to have an understanding that there are going to be moments in time when they have to make decisions that are counter to winning and for the sake of development. You know, whether it be pitch counts, whether it be, you know, batting a guy, continuing to keep a guy batting leadoff because it's important that he get more at bats because it's a priority, whether it be continuing to play a shortstop who's making error after error because he has a chance to do it, and that's what young shortstops do, go back and look, you know. So there are going to be tough decisions that run in the fate. But then when it gets down to trying to build winning teams in the minor leagues and create an expectation to win, you want to develop big league players who come up and expect to win. So I still think it's important. And when it gets to AAA, every farm director that's come after me, whether it be Neil Huntington, John Farrell, or Ross Atkins, is a pretty good list, because Ross is going to follow Neil and John and be a major league general manager too. I've told every one of these guys that AAA team has got to be a point of personal pride. You know, that is not just the free agent you sign in the winter. That's when you get an injury. It's hustling to find the best guy available, whether it's in Mexico, whether it's making a trade with another team. That I've watched other farm directors get lazy and kind of, as injuries happen and that club gets zapped with its talent, they get to the big leagues, they let the AAA team fall off. It's got to be, you have to view that AAA team as your team. It's a point of pride and you want to win. And because it's the players you have to sign during the year and fill in. That's the difference. Not just the Casey Candels and Torrey Lovellos and, you know, John Farrells you sign at the start of the season and Billy Ripken. It's the guys you sign as the season transpires.
It's interesting too right now, Kansas City, one of the reasons their young players are confident and expect to win is because they won in the minor leagues. Hosmer Mustak is that group. They won at every level, and it does make a difference when you come out.
I think it does. Yeah. One of the first things, when you're trying to shift the culture, which we'd have to do with the Indians in the early 90s, and the Royals are having to do after losing for 20 years, you're trying to undertake a cultural shift. You know, that you're telling them to feel pride in a logo that only was symbolic of the movie Major League and had no positive, you know, connotations to it. And, why would they ever feel pride? So you're talking about a massive culture shift, the one that they feel proud and that delineates them from the other 25 people back then, to date myself. And so that was one where we, infused the resources in the minor leagues. That's what we did. We infused with Dayton stuff. You know, we infuse the dollars into the facilities, into the coaches, into the strength and conditioning and nutrition, you know, and the mental skills and all those areas, and said, you matter, and you want to be proud to be a Cleveland Indian. And then gradually, those guys came up, and they did win a lot in the minor leagues, and they were talented, and they, one of the big, still, as the Royals will find out, trying to time it. And again, kind of getting back to conversations you and I have had over a lot of years, trying to time it so your pitchers and position players arrive together and you don't lose that window in a market where you can't sign and keep all your players, is still really hard.
And they're having a hard time with that right now. They're pitching.
Well, two of their best players are represented by a West Coast, a prominent West Coast. So they're going to have a hard time signing those guys.
Yeah. We're sad to see you go. Very sad.
Thank you.
Hi, Mark. Yesterday on the Clubhouse Confidential panel, we were kicking around the idea of ground ball rates among pitchers and the way that that has an influence on team building. Can you talk about that? You've got a fairly ground ball heavy staff, especially rotation.
I hope the conclusion was it's a good thing. So.
Well, I just wanted to know like how much of that is by design and how much of it is just kind of happenstance in terms of, you know, injuries and trades and stuff like that and the attrition.
You know, I don't want to be redundant, but I'd like to say it's all by design, but it was more, you know, Derek Lowe at $4 million represented the best value for a starting pitcher in those innings. It was, you know, it's not, you know, it has not been by design. You know, if it was by design, we'd have better infield defense. And
thanks. That's exactly what I wanted to know. I mean,
we've certainly looked to address our infield defense, and Casey Kochman was a big part of, you know, not just his ground ball, because his range is not exceptional, but his ability. He's made, I'm sure you've read it, he's made a number of errors he's made in you know, his career are less than we made as a team last year at first base. So, and his ability to pick, which doesn't get measured, you know, no one's objectively measuring, you know, and pick balls out of the dirt and, you know, and pick up guys in that way is exceptional. So I think him, and then if you go with Hanahan, and we'll have to weigh out decision Hanahan versus Chisenhall at third base, you know, all of a sudden you've got two well above average, two among the best in the game at first and third. And hopefully that makes up for, you know, a very young guy at second and a guy who we kind of know is not going to be good, hopefully can be average and short.
He can hit.
Anybody
else? All right.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate the time.